a collection that they accessioned recently, which is the Harry L. Anderson collection.
Beginning with a cylinder, a very famous cylinder recorded by Johannes Brahms in Vienna in 1889 as a greeting to Thomas Edison, and extending without interruption to the latest digital recordings by up-and-coming virtuosos, a vast historical panorama of piano playing has been captured for posterity. Yet the true scope and significance of this body of recordings has become known only in recent decades. With rare exceptions, few people grasp the idea that piano recordings could offer something of permanent aesthetic and scholarly importance to current and future generations. One of the chief exceptions, however, was a modest yet ardent pianophile in San Diego, California, named Harry L. Anderson. It is due largely to Harry Anderson's pioneering efforts that the recorded legacies of the entire spectrum of pianists over the past century can now be properly known, evaluated, and appreciated. Anderson devoted much of his life to collecting from all available sources every scrap of information he could obtain about every significant pianist, every detail about their training, backgrounds, careers, teaching, writing, composing, and recordings. Anderson realized that those artists who committed their talents to systematic investigation. Above all, Anderson believed that the sonic evidence of recordings was of incalculable value in documenting the styles, the schools, and the traditions, as well as the notable achievements of piano playing during the 20th century. In fact, Anderson wrote in a letter from the mid-1950s, talking about the early phase of his collecting career, and I quote, "I developed very early an insatiable curiosity to know about and hear by any means possible the playing of any pianist of any note anywhere in the world." After Anderson's death in 1990, his collection came to the International Piano Archives at Maryland. The last phase of the collection arrived last year, and final processing of the collection at IPAM is now underway. I brought along with me several interesting examples of materials that Anderson collected, and I'll be presenting those to you in a few moments after a little more background about Anderson himself and how he embarked upon this lifelong venture into the field of piano playing. Anderson was born in Guadalajara, Mexico in 1910. His father was a British subject employed by a large mining camp, and Harry Anderson chose to retain his own British citizenship. His family moved to San Diego in 1922, but by this time Anderson had already begun serious study of the piano and had encountered the artistry of several eminent pianists of the day by placing mail orders for 78 RPM discs recorded by, among others, Ignaz Jan Paderewski and Joseph Hoffmann. While attending high school and college in San Diego, Anderson often performed in recital while continuing his exploration of the field of pianism through recordings, attending concerts, and obtaining whatever published information he could find. By 1932, Anderson's collecting had given him thorough familiarity with virtually all pianists then represented on recordings, and he was able to publish several brief articles on the subject in various journals. Anderson spent the years from 1933 to 1940 in Philadelphia and in New York, continuing his independent studies and availing himself of numerous opportunities to hear all the leading performers. Anderson also amassed further recordings, catalogs, books, scores, and articles dealing with the history, study, and performance of piano music. With the outbreak of World War II, Anderson joined the Royal Air Force and was assigned to do technical work in Ceylon. And it was at that point in his career that he encountered the playing of a number of prominent players, particularly in the British Isles, where he spent a number of years before he returned to San Diego following World War II. I mentioned a moment ago that Anderson did have a solid training and background as a pianist, and one unique aspect of his work was the fact that he not only maintained his own pianistic ability, as long as he was also collecting recordings and related materials, but he performed recital programs in San Diego and in the southwestern United States. Anderson also made one commercial recording, albeit a very little known one. In 1937, a collector friend of Anderson's inaugurated what he called the International Record Agency, under whose auspices not more than two or three discs were released and marketed in infinitesimal quantities. The label was known as IRAGEN, or I-R-A-G-E-N, a contraction of International Record Agency. And on the first of those records, Harry L. Anderson himself is the featured pianist in two pieces by the then contemporary Russian pianist-composer Nicholas Metner. Anderson seems to be the first pianist to make a recording of any of Metner's music other than the composer himself, who a few years earlier had made a set of his own pieces for HMV, and this was before the post-war series of recordings that Metner made of additional works of his own that were sponsored by the Maharaja of Mysore. Here is an example of Harry Anderson's collecting interests as they extended into what was then a relatively esoteric branch of the repertoire, with a piece by Metner that is on that elusive disc that he made in 1937. Anderson plays the Metner Fairy Tale in B-flat minor, opus 20, number 1. In addition to that pioneering recording of that Metner fairy tale, Anderson also included Metner pieces on his recital programs from time to time. Following World War II, Anderson studied for a short period of time in London and then returned to San Diego, where he devoted the remaining portion of his life to teaching, collecting, and study. The main focus of his activity as a pioneer discographer became the compilation of what he called his master catalog, which is an exhaustive listing assembled from all available sources of every classical piano recording ever made from the invention of the phonograph up to the era of the long playing disc. Fully aware that such discographical data would never be available to researchers unless someone with his expertise seized the initiative, Anderson painstakingly assembled details of the contents, catalog numbers, and release dates of the recorded legacies of each and every pianist. He meticulously printed his lists by hand and added still further data as it became available. Several of Anderson's discographies were published during his lifetime in specialized journals, most notably the now defunct Recorded Sound, issued by the former British Institute of Recorded Sound, which is now known as the National Sound Archive. One pianist who particularly interested Anderson as a collector and as a connoisseur of piano playing was Ignaz Jan Paderewski. The great popularity of Paderewski with the music-loving public did not prevent Anderson from appreciating many of the qualities that Paderewski displayed, since Anderson was fortunate enough to have heard Paderewski in person on a number of occasions. He also managed to collect a complete collection of the Paderewski discs, including some unpublished material. While admittedly not representing Paderewski at his best, I'm going to backtrack a moment before we get to Paderewski to bring you one other rare example. I forgot to mention one other item in the Anderson collection that was unique in its time and which generated some interesting correspondence between Anderson and the pianist. The pianist was Ilona Eibenschütz, who was born in 1873 and was a close friend of Johannes Brahms. She managed to study a great deal of Brahms' piano music with the composer himself and was at least acquainted with Clara Schumann and a number of her pupils. But Eibenschütz retired from a rather short career as a pianist upon her marriage in the early years of this century. However, about 1903, she made several tests for the Gramophone and Typewriter Company. These apparently remained in the catalog, the two released titles at least, remained in the catalog so briefly that little was known about them until Anderson discovered one of them containing two Scarlatti sonatas in a Los Angeles record store sometime in the late 1940s. He embarked upon a correspondence with Madame Eibenschütz, who was then living in London. She could barely remember making the recordings and also commented that she was far from satisfied with them. But Anderson did send her a tape copy of the Scarlatti disc to refresh her memory of what she must have sounded like when she was active as a pianist some 50 years earlier. Here is one of the two Scarlatti sonatas on that G&T recording by Eibenschütz. And the quality of the sound is at least sufficiently good that we can discern a good deal of information about the pedaling, the articulation, and other aspects of her playing. This is the Scarlatti Sonata in E major, Longo 375, played by Ilona Eibenschütz. Incidentally, the two final chords of that piece were not written by Scarlatti, but were added by the pianist. That was a typical example of some of the rarities that found their way into the Anderson collection. And a moment ago, I was talking about his particular interest in the recordings of Paderewski, of which he compiled a preliminary discography. While not having access to the files of HMV at the time, he did manage to obtain a great deal of information about both published and unpublished material of the great Polish patriot and pianist. And he did manage also to lure into his possession some test pressings of the very first recordings that Paderewski made in 1911. This is when the young HMV company found its way to Paderewski's home in Morges, Switzerland. They had to transport the equipment to his home rather than Paderewski go to their studios. And a number of tests were made on that occasion, most of which were rejected. It is probably fairly easy to determine why this particular side was rejected by Paderewski, who seemed to be suffering from initial nervousness at the prospect of his first recordings. But nonetheless, this is a typical rarity that found its way into the Paderewski portion of Anderson's collection. Probably the third side that Paderewski ever recorded during these recordings in the summer of 1911 at his home in Switzerland. He plays two Chopin etudes successively, the first being the G-flat butterfly etude, and then the F major etude, opus 25, number 3. Harry Anderson rightly pointed out that in the case of Paderewski, the earliest recordings, such as this one, were made when he was 51 years old. And we have no documentation dating from the early and prime years of Paderewski's career, so any evaluation of his playing that we have from the existing records has to extend from the fact that he was at least middle-aged when he began his career as a recording pianist. Yet another player who interested Harry Anderson to a considerable extent was, like Paderewski, a pupil of Lechetitsky. In this case, Mark Homburg, who lived from 1879 to 1960. Homburg was Russian-born, but later became a British subject, and he recorded copiously for HMV beginning around 1910. He earned a reputation as a large-scaled freewheeling virtuoso, and shortly after Homburg's death, Anderson wrote an extended essay on Homburg's piano playing, drawing partly from his own familiarity with the recordings and partly from his own experience in hearing Homburg play on a number of occasions. What I'm going to quote from is a portion of that essay and then bring you a couple of examples, contrasting examples of Homburg's playing. Anderson said, "Homburg's pianism often inspired the critics to search beyond their usual vocabulary for words with which to describe it. He was undoubtedly a prodigious talent. Busoni once called him the greatest natural talent for the piano that he had encountered, and there was probably very little of the mastery of the piano and its sonorities that he had not at some time proved that he could achieve. But Homburg was essentially a pianist of the grand manner, and it was the size, the torrential sweep and power of his playing that first commanded attention and that also reminded many of those who heard him, including Huneker and Lechetitsky, of Anton Rubinstein. Although he could, I have been told, demonstrate a piece in his studio with the utmost of taste and polish, his temperament was too robust and exuberant for him to enjoy the role either of a perfectionist or of a self-effacing medium between the composer and the audience. It was more the life, the humor, and the large gist of music that he liked to convey to his audiences, and he preferred to leave some of the technical and musical outcome to chance rather than sacrifice the freedom of spirit that he felt necessary for his aim. Such an approach can, and often did, lead to exaggeration and distortion, and as the movement toward a purer style of playing grew in strength, Homburg became an increasingly popular target for the critics." The first of two examples from Harry Anderson's collection of Mark Homburg's piano playing is this one recorded for HMV in the early electrical period. 1926 appears to be the recording date. And Homburg plays the final movement of Beethoven's Sonata in C major, Opus 2, number 3. Thank you. In another part of his essay on Mark Homburg, Harry Anderson made this particular observation summing up Homburg's contribution as far as his recordings are concerned. He said, "No other pianist's records so give the impression that they might have been taken at random from their public performances or seem so free from any concern that cold posterity, rather than a warm and indulgent audience, might be listening to them. In that respect, they afford a uniquely candid and often exhilarating likeness in which Homburg's virtues and their corresponding sins alternate with each other or sometimes mingle in combinations that can be as stimulating in one record as they are baffling in another." Some of those qualities are present in this recording as well, which is of an early Chopin Polonaise that Homburg recorded. This Polonaise is one that was published after Chopin's death, although Chopin was probably about 17 when he composed it. It seemed to have been a favorite of Homburg's teacher, Lechetitsky, who made a reproducing piano roll of this very Polonaise, and at least three other Lechetitsky pupils, Benno Moiseevich, Alexander Brylovsky, and Ignaz Friedman, also recorded this relatively little-known Chopin work. Here is an early electrical disc by Homburg of the Chopin Polonaise in B-flat, opus 71, number 2. Thank you. I want to mention a couple other aspects of Harry Anderson's collecting activity before bringing you a final example from his collection. In addition to the master catalog that I described, I should add that plans are now under discussion for the International Piano Archives at Maryland to utilize the latest technology in making the Anderson catalog accessible to all who may have a need for it. We are also preparing for release later this year an anthology on two compact discs of historic piano recordings drawing from among the rarer items in the Anderson collection and focusing on material that has been unavailable from other sources. And an announcement will be made when that set of compact discs is ready. One other aspect of Anderson's activity was the preparation of a large assemblage of handcrafted scrapbooks, which house a wealth of contemporaneous reviews, newspaper and magazine articles, concert programs, and photographs of such legendary figures as Paderewski, Vladimir de Pachman, Moritz Rosenthal, Leopold Godowsky, Hoffmann, Rachmaninoff, and others. And much of this material has now proven to be difficult or impossible to locate even in the major reference centers. The programs which Anderson saved often reflect performances that Anderson heard in person, and frequently they contain his written notations concerning encores played and other details. The last part of Harry Anderson's life was spent in continuing the building of his collection, gathering still more data for discographical projects, and teaching a few selected students. As I mentioned, he died in San Diego in 1990 at the age of 80. His collection is now a permanent fixture within the International Piano Archives at Maryland, and it is easy to see at this point the very logical relationship between his life's work and the long-term goals of the International Piano Archives. In fact, when its predecessor organization based in New York, the International Piano Library, was established in the mid-1960s, Harry Anderson was among the charter members, eager and willing to share information, exchange ideas, and make available items from his collection as needed. Our final item is a disc that definitely qualifies as a superlative piano rarity. In fact, I think I am correct in stating that this copy from the Anderson collection is the only known copy among institutional holdings or the collecting fraternity, as far as I've been able to determine. It is a Japanese Columbia 78 of Moritz Rosenthal playing the Chopin Waltz in C-sharp minor. This recording was made for the Lindstrom Group on May 29, 1929, and was obviously intended for release on Parlophone and Odeon, but for reasons unknown, this particular take never appeared other than on this Japanese Columbia disc. Rosenthal re-recorded the waltz on April 28, 1930, and it is this version that has become rather widely available. Rosenthal also made a still later recording of the same waltz for HMV during his contract with that company in the mid-1930s. Naturally, there are interesting differences among the three versions. Here is that rare Rosenthal recording on Japanese Columbia of the Chopin waltz in C-sharp minor. Thank you.
That's the...
A fairly surprising amount of material in the Anderson collection was new to the International Piano Archives at Maryland, although some of it was not, but the printed resources, as well as the recordings, managed to enhance and complement the material already in the International Piano Archives. They represent what was collected over a period of more than 60 years by a man whose dedication to the cause of great piano playing was unrivaled. And we feel that the International Piano Archives' preservation of this material for present and future generations will ensure its continued accessibility and will stand as an enduring monument to the pioneering efforts of Harry L. Anderson. Thank you very much.
Some questions?
If you have time,
yeah, okay. I take a couple.
I'm told a couple of minutes are available for questions if anyone has any. Yes.
Who most typically uses the archives?
The International Piano Archives are used both by the students and faculty of the University of Maryland, where we are located, but more extensively by visitors from outside the university community. Some of them researchers doing dissertations and other projects, collectors, record companies, and people from abroad who are delving into various aspects of specific pianists. Visit us for both the sound recordings and the print materials. So it's a fairly wide constituency, and we actually have more visitors from outside the Maryland campus than from within. Yes?
You had given a date for that Lawrence Rosenthal recording.
Yes, I did.
I'm not aware of any source for actual recording dates that's listed from the records. Was that record made in Tokyo?
No, it was not. It was from a series of sessions, a series of takes that were otherwise issued on Parlophone and Odeon from the same date. That particular take from that date appeared only on the Japanese Columbia 78 for reasons unknown. But the Lindstrom dates for the Rosenthal recordings, at any rate, were researched by Anderson himself in a discography that was published in Recorded Sound. I don't know at the moment where Anderson did obtain it, but he seemed to be confident that all the dates for those were correct, and they were precise months and days for all of those series.
Hard to come by.
They are. For some reason, at this point, he must have worked on the discography approximately 1960, and at that point, he was able to obtain that information. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I had a chance when I was in Berlin to look at the Brahms Cylinder and to hear recordings of it that have been done several different times over and over and over again. And it seems obvious to me that the recording does not say Gruss an Herr Dr. Edison. It is Haus von Herr Dr. Fehlinger. There's no way that you could get the word Edison out of where he says Fehlinger.
Is there any evidence also as to who is actually speaking? Because it was attributed to the voice of Brahms himself, and then that was debunked, thinking that it was whoever the host for the occasion was introducing Brahms.
Yes, that, we're pretty sure about that. Dietrich Schuller feels. Mm-hmm. I forget the name of the person who he has felt was the one who was speaking there, but there's no evidence that Brahms would have been speaking, nor would he have been speaking English.
Yes, that's always been a question that some of us wondered about.
I listened to it over and over and over again, and when I tried to see whether I could hear Edison, I can't. It's failing.
I think that this is another one of those cases where it may have been wishful thinking on the part of a lot of people who initially heard it.
Whether it was Benko or whether it was Ward Marston who wrote that liner note, who wrote that in the liner note of the album.
Gregor Benko wrote the note for the release of it on the Landmarks of Historic Pianism, Volume 1, and he claimed that is what he heard the voice saying. Okay. So we'll have to attribute that to him rightly or wrongly.
Yes, I haven't spoken to Ward about it since I realized that Ward did the transfer.
I'm speaking to him next week, and I'll be sure to ask him.
Okay.
So, okay. Thank you very much. Can you take it off? Yeah.